make my films in the dark room, as you all may know. Sitting in front of a table with a cardboard with nails from underneath. On top of that cardboard, I put raw footage. On top of that raw footage, I put sound footage. And then I start hand copying, mainly using a photographic enlarger, the light source, or flashlights, or a laser pointer. And especially when it comes to the flashlights and the laser pointer, I do it frame by frame.
Austrian avant-garde filmmaker Peter Tchaikovsky. More from him soon. From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Coming up.
One of the journeys I was very interested in taking was to show, or at least to explore the idea that once you've been naked 100 times, it all goes back to basic things, which are, do I love you? Do you love me?
We'll assess the pleasures and pitfalls of teenage sex with Bang Gang, a modern love story. Also ahead.
The house kind of comes with its own built-in mythology, really. Curzio Malaparte, who commissioned the house, described it as a house like me, referring to it as a self-portrait in stone. And the house came as a product of kind of all kinds of conflicting demands and dreams.
We'll set sail for Capri in the Bay of Naples to visit an architectural marvel with a rich cinematic history. And a little later, we'll meet the Portuguese film director and past winner of the Director's Fortnight at Cannes, Marco Martins. That's all to come on The Cinema Show right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll head to London's Institute of Contemporary Arts for a special Q&A with Austrian filmmaker Peter Tchaikovsky soon. But first, writer and director Eva Husson has burst onto the cinematic stage with a lusty, revealing and somewhat discombobulating debut. Bang Gang, a modern love story, recounts an episode about a group of bored teenagers passing one long, hot summer at a friend's country house. Fusing lush, cool visuals with an electropop-inspired soundtrack, it is quite clearly a treat to behold. But it also feels a little indecisive. On one hand, it's expressing all the pleasures of sexual liberation and body acceptance in a very revealing fashion. But throw in a few STIs and some so-called slut-shaming, and things become a little more complex. Eva Husson popped into Midori House this week, and I started by asking her about the newspaper article that inspired it all.
I'm going to take you back to 1999, and yes, I basically came across that piece of news about a high school in Rockdale County in Georgia, in the States. And those kids had syphilis, basically, and the hospital discovered while they were testing them that they had parties, wild parties, and that, you know, they were organizing stuff that suddenly became out of control, and it became this big thing. And I got fascinated by the whole thing. I was like, how did that happen? You know, I come from a middle class background myself, small town, and we didn't go that far. We were bored as well. And I just, you know, started to get curious about the whole thing.
Now, something that strikes me about that then is that this was back in 1999, as you mentioned. And
the original story is from 96.
From 96. So that is obviously long before the advent of mobile phones and Instagram and
Tumblr. Well, you know, you had
sexting.
Another social network. It was called High School.
Exactly, exactly.
So
which has been around a hell of a lot
way,
longer.
Yeah.
So how then do you merge that with our attitudes of today, looking at how pictures that teens take of themselves are shared with modern technology? Often that's viewed by some people in some aspects of the media as being the worst invention that the internet has brought us. Maybe that suggests that it's not an especially modern phenomenon, perhaps.
I just tried to look at the phenomenon as a fact and not trying to judge it, because the point is, it's never going to go back. So why don't we just stare at the facts in a very simple, basic way and see what it entails in terms of behavior and reactions from the kids. And I just try to be very logic about what it means for a kid who has that outlet and who would be, you know, implied in that kind of parties? You know, what are the logistics of the social networking in these parties? And it was just quite interesting to take some paths and realize that something could happen, something else could not happen, and figure out how. It was just playful in a weird way.
Let's talk about the nakedness that's in the movie. There's a lot of bare flesh running throughout the film.
It starts with
a lot of bare butts, and then it ends with a lot of bare butts and everything in between as well. So tell me about your attitudes towards that and how you projected that onto this cast of characters, all of them teenagers, depicting teenagers, of course. And, I mean, in one way, it's sort of, you know, because you've got the parents in the film as well, and a lot of their attitudes shame their children for engaging in such behaviour. Some of them don't necessarily shame their kids. They try to educate them in a way. But then also the film takes a view that nakedness is a form of liberation and it makes you feel free. You don't come away from the film really feeling as though you've been told to treat nudity in any particular sort of way. Was that intentional on your part?
I think it comes from my background and the idea that nakedness is the most natural thing on earth. I mean, you come to the world naked and it entails a lot much more than sexuality. And one of the things, one of the journeys I was very interested in taking was to show or to, at least to explore the idea that once you've been naked 100 times, it all goes back to the basic things, which are, do I love you? Do you love me? It's not naked, being naked, that's so special, you know, about being together. A lot of people do it. It's just the connections that people have amongst themselves.
So there's early on in the film, reasonably early on, there's a moment where one of the characters first gets naked in front of his friends, and he's obviously has no problem doing that whatsoever. Later on in the film, there's a moment where one of the other characters, he's a little bit more distant and more withdrawn from the rest of them. He mentions to one of the characters who had been engaging in a lot of sex and a lot of careless behaviour that those pictures and that footage that's up online, that'll be there for life now. But then there's also the finale of the film, which features some nudity again, which seems quite liberating. Are you talking to different forms of nudity that you can, it can symbolize one thing, but then it can also symbolize another thing, and it's really the nature of what it is?
It's really about perception and the timing of, you know, nudity in itself doesn't mean absolutely anything. You know, you can see nudity at the British Museum. You know, you can see naked women being represented in sculptures. And, of course, you know, some presidents will want that veiled when they come visit it. But at the same time, it really shows how simple it can be and how artful and how basically the idea that nudity is something shocking for me represents how much we put meaning into it when really in the end we're nothing more, nothing less than regular animals.
So I noticed there were a few shots, several shots of girls kissing girls and far less of boys kissing boys. Was that a conscious decision on your part?
No, maybe because I'm a girl and I'm just more into girls kissing girls. That might be as simple as that.
Good answer. Eva Husson there, writer and director of Bang Gang, a modern love story, out in some cinemas now. Ask any visually experimental filmmaker how they honed their craft, and they'll likely recall stories of a childhood spent playing with Super 8 film. But while most people might graduate to the mainstream world of digital image capturing, Peter Tchaikovsky seems to have maintained a firm grip on that childlike enthusiasm for curiosities. With a background in journalism and political science, his artistic endeavours are quite a world away, manipulating found footage shot by others to create short, unsettling windows into worlds quite unlike anything you've likely seen before. His recent work, Instructions for a Light and Sound Machine, premiered at Cannes, while his latest piece, The Exquisite Corpus, was unveiled earlier this week here in London. We went along to the Institute of Contemporary Arts right here in London for a special Q&A following the premiere with Peter Tchaikovsky in conversation with director Peter Strickland.
I make my films in the dark room, as you all may know. sitting in front of a table with a cardboard with nails from underneath. On top of that cardboard, I put raw footage. On top of that raw footage, I put found footage. And then I start hand copying, mainly using a photographic enlarger as a light source, or flashlights, or a laser pointer. And especially when it comes to the flashlights and the laser pointer, I do it frame by frame. Before that, before I do all of that, I study my footage, I learn it by heart, I watch it over and over again, and I try to create a kind of a new story, of course, and a microstructure. So I know exactly what I'm going to do before I start working on that meter of raw footage, which is transcribed or written down in my workbook, and including which exposure time, several techniques which I apply also.
Outer space, which is 10 minutes, how long would that take, roughly?
Well, roughly I'm working from starting in October and ending end of May. That's what I call a season. And usually it takes two work seasons to create a film. Outer space was a little bit quicker. I got into a kind of a ecstasy creating that film, so it took me only, let's say, 8 months.
And you mentioned you know exactly what you're going to do, but there must be an element of chance. There must be an element of finding things by accident.
Well, what I'm trying to do is to control as much as anyhow possible of the process. It's a constant fight against chaos, which is sitting right next to my table and looking, glimpsing over my work table and trying to sneak in. And so that balance between my wish and my intention to control as much as possible on the one hand, and it's totally impossible to control everything. I mean, it starts with the shaking and shivering of the picture, scratches, dirt, malfunctions, errors, whatever.
And in terms of the sound, all these optical glitches, this optical distortion, this is not sampled. This is actually from, or you know, I wouldn't say mistakes, but this is from the process of working.
In the case of La Rivée, the very first film which we saw tonight, the 2 minutes film, what we hear is the picture itself. I printed the picture over the edge of the frame, over the edge of the film strip, right there where normally the optical soundtrack is placed. The optical soundtrack is a jagged line running next to the pictures and is being transformed inside the projector into what we hear. So when I arrived here for the deck check, I immediately found out that the projectionist had written mute next to La Rivée, the title, because he couldn't see or find a regular sound strip, so to speak. So I said, no, it's not mute. When I came to close up, and we are going to have Yves Heller and then followed by me, a second screening tonight, he said, I have a question about La Rivée, the sound. So he too had found out that there's no optical soundtrack. So that was a soundtrack created by the picture, the image itself. In the case of outer space, since the optical soundtrack is an optical element, just as the picture is, you can also collage it and recreate a new soundtrack, which I did in the case of outer space. Listening to the original film, which I had on VHS, and deciding which parts I could use and mix and create. In the case of Dreamwork, Kiavash, my composer, received from my side what I had created in the darkroom without controlling it. I simply copied the soundtrack as it was. So it was kind of a noisy version of the original soundtrack from those takes, which I used with several layers, of course. And he used bits and pieces of that too. In the case of Instructions for a Light and Sound Machine, same procedure, but what Dirk Schäfer did is that he took tiny little parts of the soundtrack which I had delivered and created micro loops, which are moving along and along the film, the soundtrack, and moving forward slowly. So stuff like that. But everything which he used, so every tiny little bits of sound, came from the darkroom.
We'll return to the ICA with Peter Tchaikovsky a little later in the show. The Portuguese director Marco Martins started his career in fashion back in 2005 with Alice, the story of a vanished child that gave us a vision of Lisbon quite unlike we're used to seeing. It was the talk of that year's festival, taking away the top honour at the director's fortnight. He's just completed his latest film, São Jorge. We sat down with Marco in Lisbon to discuss the role of festivals in today's film market and why he followed his victory at Cannes by taking a job as a debt collector.
For the last 20 years, there had been a tendency in the film market and the film industry, you know, like with the festivals. And every year there's more and more film festivals. And the festivals tend to, you know, pay more attention to small cinematographies. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, like Portuguese cinema or Romanian cinema, you know, or Argentinian cinema, you know, all of a sudden become so well known around the world. And this idea that you go to film festivals and you see, you know, like not mainstream cinema, that it's like, and you see other forms of expression. And that's what people, you know, are looking for when they go to film festivals. Because then, you know, to release a film in film theaters, that's a whole different story, you know. You can release it in France, maybe in England, you know, but it's very, very hard. I decided to write this script in the, as a reaction, you know, from the film, my last film was called How to Draw a Perfect Circle, which was like a very close story, an incest story between a brother and a sister. And I want, you know, to talk about like the poor neighborhoods that the ethnies that live around Lisbon, on the suburbs. And it was a period of our big crisis. It was like everybody was like losing their jobs. A lot of Brazilians were coming back to Brazil. A lot of, you know, people from Africa were, well, because construction stopped. And also I was working with the same actor that I did Alice, because we wanted to work together in the project again. Since we did Alice, we didn't did anything afterwards. And so I discovered there was this kind of companies. There are like debt collectors that collect money from debts. They buy it and it's legal. And a lot of companies and a lot of you know, individuals were being, you know, arrested for, you know, and being persecuted from these companies and to try to have them the money back. And so it's, I tried to do a lot of investigation on these companies, and for like 6 months I worked with them. And it was the boot point of the film. It was from there that I started to write it. And I discovered a lot of workers on that companies. They were from the suburbs. They were boxers or kickboxers, or people work on nightclubs, on security guards and stuff like that. And that's why I start to do a work on this kind of dangerous neighborhoods. And also, in the past years, I have some theater experience with small ethnical groups on that neighborhoods, and I had this desire to make a film that, for the first time, for me, of course, was a mixture between documentary and fiction, with a lot of non-actors. Non-actors, a lot of non-actors.
Portuguese director Marco Martins. Still to come, we'll set sail for the Italian island of Capri. But up next, more from Peter Czajkowski at the ICA.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll head to Capri soon for a tour of the famed Villa Malaparte. For now, though, it's back to the ICA here in London to hear more from Peter Tchaikovsky's Q&A with director Peter Strickland.
To play devil's advocate, I think with technology becoming what it is, with software and apps and everything, say, for example, there was an app that could do what you spent two seasons doing, if you could do it with a few clicks. I mean, we spoke about this, about the element of chance and yeah. the process of living through it.
Well, when it comes to apps, as I mentioned Barcelona before, as a beginning of this week, and I succeeded in downloading my boarding pass, so the barcode, and I was so proud of me that I finally got to get, well, with the help of the receptionist, I have to confess, yeah. So I don't even know what apps means. But basic, well, of course, I do know, I have a vague idea. It's something which helps you to do things with your cell phone, yeah, where I'm always afraid, and all of a sudden I get a 4,000 euro bill, like a friend of mine, twice in a row, by the way, simply by pressing wrong buttons or whatever. Anyway, what I try to do is to make films, to create films, handmade films, which look in a way that it's totally clear, this is handmade cinema, this is a cinema which could not be done with a computer. This is cinema which reveals a kind of a beauty which is can only be achieved with the medium of analog cinema. And my main message with all of my darkroom films is, hey people, this is the beauty we are going to lose right now. In a few years, it will be gone. If you think of the middle section of Instructions for a Light and Sound Machine, where the film tears and Duco ties the filmic death, which is when the film tears, it's being ripped apart. Yeah, this is a joke, so to speak, which in 10 years, nobody will understand. The perforation holes coming in from out the space where the material, the filmic material, becomes the main actor in the film, basically next to Barbara Hershey. In 10 or 15 years, people will start wondering, if not now, what are those funny holes on the side that are coming into the picture? So we are really losing something right now, and nobody can stop it. And I have a remaining lifespan of, hopefully, knock on wood, 30 years. And as long as I live, it will somehow last. So, and what's afterwards? So I don't care, or I can't care anyway. So.
I mean, it's turned into a boutique industry of sorts. I think in London now you have these vans that process film, I believe. But
yes, there's a niche. There's a huge niche being developed. Again, coming back to Barcelona, where we visited a film lab called Crater, and you have totally as a nerds, in the best sense of the word, people, enthusiasts, totally addicted and totally convinced of analog cinema, cooking their own emulsion, creating their own film prints, buying and rescuing machines from all over Europe and somehow transporting it to the film lab. Normally the transport costs is the biggest part of the whole deal. And that happens, let's say, everywhere, which is not true, but at many places in Europe. Everywhere would include Asia or whatever, Africa, where it does not happen. But anyway, when we went to Mongolia last year, even I, there was not a single analog projector left in the whole country. Not a single one.
That's it's so just fast. It's only been a few years.
Just a footnote. Anyway, but that niche is establishing itself. And coming back to my 30 years, I'm really curious as to what that niche will look like in 30 years, if there will be a tiny little parallel universe still existing and thriving, and I don't know, we'll see.
Peter Tchaikovsky speaking after the UK premiere of his latest short film, The Exquisite Corpus. He was in conversation with the film director, Peter Strickland. Now, you might have heard our recent program recorded on location at Rome's wonderful home of cinema, the Cinecittà Film Studios. Well, like Cinecittà, Villa Malaparte on the island of Capri has some strong ties to classic film, and its story also shares its roots with Italy's fascist regime under Mussolini. Today, the house is the private domain of its original owner's family and off-limits to the public. But curious observers can set sail around the island for a glimpse at the stunning clifftop home. Justin Jekyll is the curator of a series of architecture on film events at the Barbican here in London. He takes us on a tour.
So the Villa Malaparte was built between 1938 and 42 by an Italian writer and polymath, the somewhat controversial Curzio Malaparte. It exists in a protected part of the Capri coastline on an outcrop of cliffs. The villa actually was abandoned after writer Malaparte's death in 1957, and it's thought he only really lived there for 1 year out of the 15 years that he had the option to. The film, of course, gained its broadest notoriety through its use by Godard in the film Le Mépris in 63. And since then, it's really existed as a bit of a myth and a muse in the public imagination, certainly for designers and those in the visual realm. Karl Lagerfeld shot a collection of photographs that was published as a book there in 98. In 99, basically a love letter from the architectural community was written to the house in the form of another book, where the great and the good profess their undying love for the structure as one of the most amazing pieces of modern architecture ever to be built. And even then, in the luxury mode, it's been used for purposes as diverse as being the home of a Zenga fragrance launch, where the house saw it as a testament to masculine determination and intensity, and even as the model for the armatures of a pair of Persil sunglasses more recently. And then this year, of course, it became the flagship image on the poster of Cannes Film Festival. The house kind of comes with its own built-in mythology, really. Curzio Malaparte, who commissioned the house, described it as a house like me, referring to it as a self-portrait in stone. And the house came as a product of kind of all kinds of conflicting demands and dreams. Originally an Italian architect who was used extensively for Mussolini's fascist regime, Adalberto Libera, was commissioned to build the house. But he actually renounced authorship over the house after many ongoing design disputes with Malaparte. And Malaparte then afterwards, the writer, has been credited with the design, really, of the house itself. But Malaparte himself had a really troubled relationship with the Mussolini regime. He was a former member of the National Fascist Party and had previously been exiled to the islands of Ischia and Lipari by the Mussolini regime for writing dissident texts that didn't have their approval. It's a difficult thing. Modern architecture has certainly been given a very bad rap, specifically by Hollywood. And there's questions of whether it's kind of architecture or money that is being denigrated on screen. In films like Le Mépris, I mean, the Casa Malaparte is very much a symbol of kind of luxury and decadence, as well as the meetings of the classical and the modern worlds. The house, of course, is owned by the American producer of the film within the film in Le Mépris. And throughout the film, it's kind of will they, won't they pull of will they go to Capri. So we're very much presented with this villa as the place of the final showdown. But more broadly than that, I mean, the villa is really a trophy in Le Mépris, and is seen as such in so many other films of Hollywood.
Justin Jekyll setting sail with us around the island of Capri for a look at Villa Malaparte. The next Architecture on Film event takes place on the 23rd of June with Serbian-Danish film Flotel Europa. And that is it for this week. Today's show was edited by the delightfully dedicated Nina Norick and researched by Jolene Goffin. Join us again next week when we sit down with one of the stars of the mind-bending film Remainder and the star of the Italian action movie Sabura, Pier Francesco Favino, will join me here in the studio, alongside director Stefano Solima. We'll also discuss his upcoming sequel to the Mexican crime drama Sicario, starring Emily Blunt. That's next week on The Cinema Show. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your weekend.